Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to episode 89 of the OFA Basics Discover podcast. I'm your host, Derek Craig, and this is the show where we learn something new about our incredible industry on every single episode. Today, I'm joined by two fantastic gentlemen. One of them is going to be my co-host, and the other has more experience than the two of us combined. I'm talking about Nicholas Brin and Jack Hamlin. They'll be joining me in on the conversation in just a moment. We're going to be talking today about oil and gas facility design with a specific focus on Colorado. So yes, home of Prop 112 and Governor Jared Polis, for those of you that are familiar with what goes on out here. I've worked in a few different basins now across the country, and what goes on here in Colorado is quite unique. And many outsiders don't even realize that Colorado is one of the top five oil-producing states, and a majority of that oil production happens right here in what we call the Front Range. So literally just miles from Denver. And so homes are literally being built hundreds of feet away from oil and gas facilities that produce hundreds or thousands of barrels of oil per day, and of course the associated gas. And this leads to some pretty interesting dynamics, of which I can now speak to personally, having lived out here for a couple years now. So advocacy has never been more needed in our industry, and our guest is going to give us the scoop on how to get involved and probably give us a swift kick in the butt while he's at it. So we've got a lot here to cover today. Before I can go any further, I've got someone new to introduce you to. He's a sophomore petroleum engineering major at the Colorado School of Mines, Nicholas Brin. How's it going today, Nick?
Man, it's going very well. I'm sitting here on the School of Mines campus and very excited to be part of the podcast. Thanks for having me along.
Absolutely. So give us a scoop on your background real quick. This is the first time anybody's heard of you on this show. So you know, what's your background? How do you like CSM? What all you get involved with? Just catch us up, man.
Well, yeah, you've said most of the highlights. I'm a sophomore here at the School of Mines, undergrad, pretty heavily involved in the department. I'm the current AADE chapter president and involved with the SPE chapter here on campus, trying to get more exposure to all elements of the industry. Currently, I'm interning down at an EOR consulting firm here in town called Surtech. So getting a little bit of reservoir engineering experience there. And looking forward to getting whatever other experience I can in the future. Right now, the situation's a little unsure, but I was originally slated to work with Concho this coming summer down in the Permian. And we're trying to convince Conoco to honor those offers. And so if any luck, I'll be down there this summer.
Yeah, well, best of luck to you there. I know today and this week, and we're sitting above $60 oil now, so... I'm hopeful for this year, but I think we're actually going to talk a little bit about some future expectations also for the oil and gas industry on this episode. So lots to talk about, but glad to have you on board. I love hearing how involved you are, especially as a sophomore. So I think you're setting yourself up pretty well for success there. So, but without further ado, our guest today, Jack Hamlin, he's ran an engineering firm called Summit Engineering, sold it to a larger firm named Sargent & Lundy, and is now a VP of their energy and industrial group. So Jack has been pretty active on LinkedIn, so definitely be sure to send him a friend request. He also helped begin the Energy Strong movement that you've all probably heard of by this point. So Jack joins us here today. How's it going, Jack?
Hey, good morning, guys. Glad to be here. Going well.
glad to have you. So I know basically I've seen you all over LinkedIn, and you know, since moving to Colorado, I'm sure I would have seen you in person a lot if COVID wasn't in 2020. Mm-hmm. At a lot of events, but I know you're pretty active. Tell us a little about yourself. What got you into oil and gas, and where you're at today?
Yeah, I'll give you the abbreviated version. my entrance into oil and gas was a little unique in that I never had any family in the oil field. My entrance into oil and gas was driven out of my own kind of natural curiosity. I had no family in the oil field. I went to school in Greeley, and I would see a lot, some oil and gas activity. And when I would see roustabouts and rig hands out in the field in what's now, you know, the DJ Basin, mm-hmm. I always thought, man, what a cool American job, bringing American energy to American people. And, you know, in those days and all the way up until, you know, about a year ago, American energy independence, that was the rally cry of every politician and even American citizen. We wanted to be energy independent. We wanted to rely on ourselves for our energy, which, you know, oil and gas was the and fossil fuels were the energy that powered all other industries and energies. So that, you know, the price of a gallon of gas was important to people, and it still is. And heating your homes and your electricity is just as important. So there's these livelihood issues and these quality of life issues that came into play. And as a business major, you know, I traveled around the world and saw, here's this commodity that's available just like Coca-Cola. Everywhere around the world, I could put a gallon of gas in a motorcycle or a car or a boat and, you know, or get in an airplane, and all the things that enhanced my life happened to be touched by this incredible resource. And so that's how I got into it. It was an American industry. It was almost like the last bastion of American manufacturing. And it provided a natural resource that was American to American people. And I'm a pretty patriotic guy and love our country. Like, and I really love the workforce in it. I think we've got the best talent and the brightest minds in the world here. And that some of that's been leveraged into the oil field industry. And so, yeah, my entrance into it was one out of curiosity and one out of pride. And that remains today.
Yeah, no, I think you hit a lot of definitely some highlights there. I wish we did a better job as an industry of showcasing the talent and just how much technology and everything goes into our industry itself, and just speak that story better. Because unless you're around it, sometimes you know we don't see that. But so that's
very, you know, and to that point, not to interrupt you, but to that point, our industry has always been terrible at marketing, and the consequence of that and not speaking up and discussing the industry itself is rooted in science and technology. Mm-hmm. We've done a terrible job of marketing that and informing the average citizen of that. And that's why we are where we are today. People, when they think of the oil field, there's a dirty stigma attached to it, an unsafe stigma. Having worked in it for over 16 years, I see the opposite. And so that's kind of why I fight for it, is that the narrative isn't entirely correct, not even close. And, you know, that's on us to go educate the average citizen that, you know, people turn on the news and they listen to what's on the news.
For sure.
What's on the news doesn't portray an accurate picture of the American oil and gas industry. So it's really on us from a grassroots level to go inform and educate our neighbors, our friends, our family, get back into some schools and do career days, stuff that's been missing for probably the last decade.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. A lot of good, strong messages there, and got a lot to talk about that here later in the episode for sure. Now, what you talk about it with how you got into oil and gas. So that's definitely, so your interest kind of led you into it, but I'm wondering, you know, what was your first role? How did you actually step into the industry?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for asking, because I'm proud of it. So I got into the industry. I worked for IBM out of college. And, you know, when I would get stressed out at work or have my midlife crisis, I would take a drive and I would drive around. And again, the oil field workers always caught my eye. And I thought, man, what a cool job. So as I got into it and wanted to get into it, one of my business mentors owned and operated a staffing firm. It was called Ensicon. It's still around. And they provided recruiting services to heavy industrial clients that were in oil and gas, mining, and power generation. And I've always kind of been a nut about, you know, rocks and geology. I was always good at that stuff. And he needed some help kind of restarting and growing a staffing firm. And the fact that it was a peripheral oil and gas industry, and then I looked at it from a perspective of, this is going to like hyper accelerate my networking capability. I've always been taught and mentored that networking is by far one of the best tools you could ever use to not only job hunt, but to further your career, and then also lift up others and help them. And so we negotiated back and forth for a couple months and came to work for Ensicon staffing, did that for about 5 years, met all sorts of engineers, designers, drafters, project controls, you name it. And then as I was working, several clients had been making me offers. Some of them were, you know, in the upstream, midstream space, and some of them were on the engineering side. I chose the engineering side. Went to work for one of my clients at the time. We had a great time there, learned a ton, looked at how it was operating. And as a business guy, I thought, well, I think I can do this better. And so I came over to Summit Engineering, which was an existing company, but a real small one. And me and my two partners, I wrote a business plan. We set off we developed kind of a company mission. And from there, we attacked that mission with everything we had. And the business model we had ended up being unique enough that we accelerated and we did a great job and we made an impact. And then out of that, as the industry started to face some headwinds, we launched Energy Strong to combat the narrative. So it's been this really wholesome movement, this really organic movement for myself to kind of start out at an entry level, ground level, not knowing anything about really the industry technically, learning it. Engineers and designers that I took to lunch and I met with, they taught me. They were very gracious that's really led to me also giving back. I mean, I could have never done what I did without the tribal knowledge from engineers and other businessmen that helped me understand the industry and what was lacking there so that I could identify a market and really attack that. So really interesting way to get into it. And then now I feel like, it's in my blood. I feel like I want to do this the rest of my life. And I really do enjoy what I do every day.
Yeah. And I think what you're talking about with basically sharing knowledge with others, like starting Energy Strong about the same time as you yourself was learning that, I think that's a really rich perspective. And I wish people would do that more as students or people who are coming in the industry or whatever. It's like, it's sometimes harder even to go back and retroactively figure out what messaging we can give, how we can teach people. Because at some point, once we get more and more in tune with the industry, we forget the basic questions that we asked. Forget the basic perspectives and how the outsiders might see the industry versus how we perceive it now and what's really simple to us. We might need explained more to them. So I like the fact that it sounds like you were starting that about the exact same time. And I'm sure that made it pretty easy to share that with others. Yeah, like you said.
Yeah. I mean, I was lucky to have some really good mentors. And if I had any advice for anybody beyond, investing in Tesla and Bitcoin 10 years ago, it would have been that get yourself a really good mentor and start developing your network as soon as possible. When I got into this industry, no one marketed oil and gas services on LinkedIn. Not that I was a pioneer or anything, but I just never saw it. And here I was, this outsider. You know, I didn't take thermodynamics or anything like that. I saw all this stuff going up and I thought, this is the coolest industry I could think of. There's all American products and workers delivering this resource. And so I started marketing that. You know, oil and gas didn't have much in the way of like sexy marketing. So I started putting cool pictures up of stuff we were working on and highlighting our people and the knowledge and the technical experience that they lended to that. And it made a difference. I mean, marketing, now it's prevalent everywhere. When I started, everybody thought I was this nutty social media guy. And I posted a lot. I'd get on airplanes to Midland, Texas, and people say, hey, I saw you on LinkedIn. I said, well, I didn't see you. Why? If it works, why aren't you doing it too? Like, let's get the message out there. So yeah, it was, get some good mentors that can really kind of keep you in check and point in the right direction and guide you. And then network. I've personally never, ever put together a resume to get a job. I've done it through experience and networking and people know who I am and then have offered me positions. And that's pretty powerful. You get to kind of cherry pick that way instead of being beholden to a HR machine that's searching keywords on your resume. Writing, being in recruiting, writing your resume is just as important as networking. Don't get me wrong, but networking for me has always been the kind of the pinnacle of what people should be doing to not only advance their own careers and self-interest, but to also help others.
Yeah, no, definitely. A lot of good messages there. So kind of step us into the story of where you got in with SNL or Sergeant Lundy, right?
Sure.
How that transition went? When you wrote your business plan for Summit, did it include, you know, being bought out? You're stepping in with a bus full of engineers, and you're the main business guy. How'd that go?
Yeah. Well, I also did have a couple other really good business people that were by my side. Some of them had engineering degrees, but had since moved into kind of more business management, which the industry, you know, even an oil company needs business people, and they need all sorts of support.
Oh yeah.
But as I developed the business plan, any good business plan has an exit strategy, and I'd like to say that I planned it perfectly because I had a 5-year plan, like most businesses do, and we sold our business 2 weeks shy of our 5 years. So that was a really neat. I didn't plan it to the week like that, but certainly having a vision, having a plan that we worked against, for sure helped us get to where we wanted to. It helped me work harder. It helped everybody else come together. And the goal behind selling, not only as an entrepreneur and a builder, that those were important to me, but also to get into, you know, partner up with the right company to provide bigger and better opportunities for the people that worked for us. You can only grow so fast organically. And that's the purpose of mergers and acquisitions, is to kind of take those leapfrog jumps. It was built into a plan in some way. The growth of the industry did kind of accelerate it. We were approached, you know, 2 years into growing our business, we started to get approached by several companies, and they always kind of throughout that 6 years of growing, it was that, you know, we'd get offers and engagements all the time. We turned, of course, all of them away and wouldn't engage selectively because there was intrinsic value in what we were building, and we didn't want to have our legs cut out in the middle of really important growth periods. Mm-hmm. And we would, you know, having as a recruiter, I staffed virtually every employee that we hired, and at our peak, we were like 142 people. Oh, and nice. So I had, you know, not to be too cliche, but they were family. I treated them like that. We played softball together. They came to my house for dinners. We celebrated births and birthdays and marriages and all that stuff. Now, with any family, there's some dysfunction there, and you got to make hard decisions, and we certainly did those. But as we grew, I wanted to make – it was very important to me that we didn't just go with someone that wanted to buy us because we wanted to get out and try something else. It was that company that we merged with had to have similar mission, vision, values, which were – all of ours were focused around a customer service component and giving people the latitude to be creative and think outside the box and deliver the utmost in quality. So those were the kind of benchmarks that we set. And when Sergeant Lundy came along, they sent their top brass out to meet with us, so we knew they were serious. And then as we reviewed their website, did our due diligence, talked to them back and forth, it was very clear that even though they were a huge company, global, they'd been around since 1891, all of their values matched ours almost in lockstep. They were customer service focused. They focused on big mega projects like nuclear power plants, but they also did really small things like as-built and arc flash studies. And that's what we grew up on. So it was a really, really good alignment. And the more we talked, the more we felt like, wow, there is like tons of synergy here. And this will open up these doors for these engineers to, you know, work on things outside of the oil and gas facilities we were working on. We wanted to keep that as a core component, and we always will, but we can leverage some of the solar experience and the wind turbine experience and some of the transmission line and substation services that company offered to make our engineers better and let them work on those things too. And as we're looking at, you know, Colorado, you had mentioned earlier, Colorado. Yeah. We were the tip of the spear for what we now call ESG. And that was done through regulation, right? Like, driving down emissions and being, you know, figuring out technologies to capture and drive down emissions and using solar panels to offset coal energy usage and using that acreage to provide power and store power. It was just a totally natural fit. And then the leadership team at Sergeant Lundy, it was impressive. I mean, we were growing the thing just, you know, three guys in the oil and gas industry doing the best we could. And we had a great business, but man, these guys were polished, and they had, you know, all the things over 125 years that a company would develop to be successful. We instantly got access to that. So the day we closed, which was officially April 1st, but we did it March 31st to avoid the April Fool's thing, because I don't think anybody would think we would sell. But the, went really well. We were right in the middle of oil was starting to drop. So that was, the markets were acting a little strange. And then COVID was starting to take grip. And it was kind of before everything really, really locked down. But we decided, hey, let's do this merger and roll up completely. We'll do this transaction completely remote through Teams. And we actually did our kickoff meeting and our all hands meeting. We did all of that remotely. First time it was done in company history. Went great. And so the fact that a company that big and that, old in terms of ages has been around, the fact that they were so innovative there, that was a really cool way to kick it off. I mean, I would have rather been it had been in person, of course, but the fact we were able to do that, it spoke volumes to me that, hey, these guys have their stuff together, because it required a ton of coordination and orchestration behind the scenes to make that happen and for everything to kind of go off without a hitch. So the merger was well timed. The company has been outstanding. I mean, you've seen horror stories, and you see that there's kind of a pattern that happens. If a company gets acquired, the acquiring firm usually guts the company to some degree, mm-hmm. takes their MSAs, takes some of their good people, and then eliminates a competitor and chugs on down the road. For this, it's been, we're a bolt-on business group. Having been in Colorado and been at the front end of some of this really cutting edge design and environmentally friendly design, reducing the environmental impact both from a footprint and emissions level. Now that's a nationwide, not necessarily a mandate yet, but certainly everybody's got ESG on the mind. How do we not clean up these facilities, but how do we make them more efficient and capture mm-hmm. everything that we should and reduce flaring or even eliminate flaring? All the wasteful kind of things associated with it, how do we get better? And that's always been the drumbeat of oil and gas. Something I'm proud of is that even working in Colorado and Wyoming and Texas, they've always been ahead of the regulation. So it's always get to the regulation and set the bar higher. And we're really proud of that. That's a message we should really say all the time that, hey, we have no problem with regulation. We've been great at that. In fact, we've always exceeded that. There's just not really a organization in our industry that takes that baton and successfully markets it to my neighbors, to your neighbors. I mean, the narrative that they get is that oil and gas is reluctant to change, and it's it's a dying industry, and neither of those things are true.
Yeah. A lot of good messages there. And the story about, getting in with SNL. That's a great story. We could definitely talk about that even the rest of the episode, but want to use that as a transitioning point into, you talked about facilities. You talked about some of the really cool things you guys are doing on that front. For those that are just utterly unfamiliar with, this portion of upstream, can you first hit off on, what you would consider like a well site facility? What is that? And then what all goes into the design of building that?
Yeah. So once commercial and the subsurface teams decide that, hey, this is going to be an area we're drilling, and it's going to be these are going to be our production rates, and this is what it's going to look like composition wise, they'll engage a company like ours to help look at the IP rates, the long-term production rates, what the composition, oil, gas, water is. And then our teams will engage all different disciplines, process, mechanical, electrical, structural, to size and select equipment and piping and pumps and site location and layout to develop a facility that will handle the production of that well safely, economically, and with some longevity and good operation. So we're looking at things, 20, 30 years ago, it was kind of slap some production stuff in the field, and the operators kind of dealt with something different every time.
Yeah.
Now we're trying to standardize. We're reducing footprint. We're always thinking about how do we consolidate and put everything on one pad or as few pads as possible. So you've got all these brilliant minds in there. It's not, the well itself is what the diameter of a dinner plate, right? But you got tons of stuff coming out of it, and you got to handle it, and it's got to be not only safe, but it has to be redundantly safe. So there's several safety systems built into that. And that's where we really leverage talent, like Nick and others that come out of School of Mines. A lot of our talent comes out of the School of Mines. And with that, you've got to have a very good, strong group of drafters and designers to take that data and translate it onto paper or into the computer models and the softwares to make sure that it's easy to read and it's people that are building in the field don't have questions and that you're not putting a valve 20 feet in the air so that you need a man lift to get there. So as you know, to answer your question, what's the facility? Well pad facility, it's been really cool. We've worked from North Dakota to South Texas, and a well pad facility is different in those places. And so we have to sometimes take knowledge from one, and especially with the freeze ups in Texas lately, we may take some of these Arctic packages that we do here in Colorado and these environmentally low emissions tankless facilities and put them down in Texas to for them to meet not only environmental compliance and regulations, but also prevent freeze ups. You know, you don't think about heat trace a lot in South Texas because it's semi-tropical, but I think now they will. You know, heat trace would be a pretty good investment right now. One cracked valve can, you have a lifetime of heat trace on that facility. So the well pad facilities for us have been great. I mean, we've not only, even in the last 5 to 10 years, you're not doing the same cookie cutter design. You're deploying new technologies and equipment, and you're consolidating and making things more efficient and modular. So as over the last 5 years, as accelerated, oil and gas has been super proactive of, you know, not only driving down CapEx costs, but making things safer, cleaner, smaller footprint, less visible. And that's where we come in. We really, you know, the engineers and the designers on the front end and the business people and commercial folks, they're figuring out how do we make these things, you know, fit in a smaller space and not be a blight on the landscape or be an eyesore in neighborhoods or local areas. And that's our role, is to help them achieve those goals. So we work with that. That's a core competency for us, is the well pad work.
Yeah. Hey, Jack, I have a question for you. You know, us really young bucks don't really understand a lot about facilities. It seems like, especially in petroleum engineering, that kind of becomes a back burner topic. Can you explain to an ignoramus like myself what some of the staples of facility engineering are? You know, what are some of the main things you think about on a well pad? You know, what are some of the main devices and components that go into that most commonly?
So the wild card, and I'm not an engineer, so I'm going to just tell you from a business level, and when I sit through project meetings, you know, I think I have a really good take on it because I don't look at it from an extremely technical level, but from an overall facility level, the wild card's always the land that you get. So you're always working in like the edge of a crop circle or a strange little part of land that's been negotiated that maybe a landowner wants away from the house, or, you know, a lot of it's taking place on private land. So you've got a lot of times unique footprint. Now you've got to figure out what equipment's going to be needed to handle this volume and how is it going to fit into this spot. But not only how's it going to fit in that spot, how's it going to look good aesthetically? How's it going to fit operationally so that there's some sort of logic to the design without piping and electrical go crisscrossing back and forth? So on the facility side, the focus there is obviously no one likes to spend CapEx dollars, and they want to look to standardize and modularize so that they can, you know, especially with shale gas, your IP drops very quickly. So you don't necessarily need the separators and the equipment on site. You want to be able to plug those in and pull them out. So from the engineering side, on the facility side especially, you're looking at not only how do I get to the smallest footprint, most efficient footprint possible, but how do I make it so I can still get trucks in there and cranes in there to pluck and pull equipment and keep the site there for longevity. So super, super efficient, super, you know, laid out to be operational. You want to look at safety systems and making sure that everything's as safe as possible, and that even things like watershed and drainage plans and retention plans, you don't want any water or anything on the plant. You don't want anybody to get out of a car and twist an ankle or a truck and twist an ankle. So you're looking at operability, you're looking at safety, you're looking at longevity, you're looking at pigging and integrity work and being able to get inspectors on site to check equipment. So it's very robust. Like, what does it include? It includes everything you would do with a major capital project like a gas plant, but it's on a little well pad, and some of them are two or four wells, and some of the mega pads are 32, 64 wells. They're huge. XTO is doing huge production islands, which are, I think, hundreds of well pads and these multi-well pad facilities.
Is that Texas?
New Mexico. So yeah, it's a great question. It's using all disciplines from engineering and commercial and business and project controls and figuring out. And then, of course, the logistical part, like, you know, you still have to have room for stuff to get it, think ahead, room for trucks to back in compression or equipment and drop it safely and get in and out of there and avoid power poles and things like that. So you've got this huge orchestration of multidisciplined people working together to not only build a facility, but build it safely and turn it around very, very quickly. So a ton of, where can we standardize? That's kind of the big deal. We want standardized. We want to kind of, you know, the term cookie cutter. You want to cookie cutter these things as best as you can. And that's a challenge. You got diverse geographical areas with different types of production, and you got to kind of, it's not a one size fits all approach, but you've got to have a very scalable and diverse facility that can handle a lot of different conditions, weather, production, maintenance, that type of thing. So great question, but virtually, you know, I know a lot of petroleum engineers that work on the facility side, and having that subsurface knowledge is great when you're designing a facility to handle it on surface.
Yeah, great, wonderful. Thank you for the answer. Kind of a follow-up to that same question. What, you know, you mentioned that you'll see, production batteries, you'll see separators, you'll see all kinds of surface equipment like that. You mentioned that there's a diversity of things that you'll see depending on the circumstance and situation. But what are some of those actual components that are ubiquitous in a production, you know, facility arrangement? What do you have to have? What will you always see at every well pad? What are some of the main actual structures that you'll encounter?
Lots of pipes and pumps, obviously, but then like main equipment, you'll have heater treaters and you'll have separators. Separators are huge. You're drilling a well and a lot of different stuff's coming out. You got, you know, salt water, you got production fluids, you got oil, and you got gas. You want to separate all that stuff out. Different areas, you've got VRTs and you've got combustors and flares and tanks. The application, I mean, you go down a list of a couple dozen pieces of equipment. It truly is tailored to the environment. You know, a lot of areas like Colorado, you won't see many, if at all, flares, especially in the future. In some cases, you'll start to see, like we've started designing tankless facilities. So a typical arrangement on a well pad battery is tankage. Right now we're in Colorado, we're designing and continue to modify and perfect tankless design where everything's pipelined. So you don't have tanks, you don't have the emissions associated with tanks. You don't have the environmental risk or the eyesore of tanks, and it's just production facilities there. And then they pipeline it to another site. And it's a win-win if you can get that pipeline infrastructure. So to answer your question, it's all over the map, but yeah, things like separators and heater treaters and tankage and VRTs and flares, that's pretty normal. But as things progress, you're looking at applying new technologies. So things like FLIR cameras that can detect tank levels inside the tanks and modifying equipment and instrumentation to detect any sort of plumes or leakage or upset. And automation's huge. Automation, you're seeing a ton of automation now applied to well pad facilities, to where they're it can take pictures of every car and person coming on and off the site. It can alert people remotely, instantly. It's recording any sort of emissions or fugitive emissions or leaks. And so it's all over the map, and it depends on the region. Yeah, that's been kind of the fun part, the colorful part of this job is it's exactly why you need engineering support, to understand exactly what you need, not to, you know, if you don't need two separators, I'd say that the engineering pays for itself. So you're always having these, the one really, really cool thing about what we do is that it's never been static. We've never just accepted the status quo. It's always been looking at the equipment and what's on site and how do we apply the latest in technology and efficiency to that site. So where before you used to maybe have flares, they can put MRUs on there to liquefy gas and then transport it. So you don't have to flare the gas. There's companies right now that are taking the tail gas on some of these facilities where there's some stranded assets and they're putting bit miners on the end of it. And so these midstream companies are using the gas to generate power to mine Bitcoins. That's a pretty cool solution to that problem. So that's not standard equipment, but who knows? It could become that. It makes sense. Bitcoin's worth $55,000 or something right now. So pretty cool.
Yeah. What's MREs? I haven't heard of that before.
A mechanical refrigeration unit. Basically, okay. It takes the gas, liquefies it. You can truck it offsite as opposed to flare it. They're not totally common yet, but we've seen them on applications in remote areas of Wyoming or Colorado where there's a stranded asset. They can't, it's getting harder and harder to build pipeline. And you can't flare it. What do you got to do? You got to solve that problem. So mm-hmm. liquefy it and truck it out of there. And that's a solution.
Yeah, definitely. You hit on a lot of really interesting points there. And I mean, ultimately the well site, right? The well site facility is basically just trying to separate everything that comes out of the well into the components, right? Oil, gas, and water.
Sure.
The main typical components there. But people who are outside of this area of the industry probably don't realize too, just how, I was going to ask you to expel on it a little bit more, but how automated everything is. And just the fact, completely manless, and you can be producing, tens of thousands of barrels a day, right, depending on the facility and the design. So pretty incredible what all can be done out there and is engineered, and just how much automation equipment, electrical equipment is even needed on a standard site too. And I didn't even know some of the security stuff you were talking about sound pretty cool, or that you can have it looking for fugitive emissions with camera systems there. That's really
cool. So a friend of mine that helped co-found Energy Strong, he's, we went through testimony together at the Capitol. We identified the industry's in for a major change because these communities, you touched on it earlier, having firsthand experience. So in Colorado, it's a unique environment in that you have oil field production and oil fields that have been there for years. They were here when I was going, back to college in the late 90s and early 2000s. And it used to be at 120th and I-25 north of town, there wasn't anything till you got to Loveland. And then there wasn't anything till you got to Greeley. Going to Greeley from my house in Littleton felt like I was going to Montana. Now it's all connected. And on top of that oil field, oil field didn't move into housing developments. It's vice versa. And that's a very important distinction because communities were built on top of existing production fields. Yeah. You hear all the time, oil fields moving into the communities. It's the opposite. And people were not educated about that properly. We can, there's a million reasons to blame for that. But the fact is you've got surface development happening on top of existing production, and all these setbacks are now occurring. And then you've got Colorado's always been leading edge when it comes to, open space and people having room. It's kind of that Western type mm-hmm. state philosophy. You want, big skies, open spaces. And so you've got development, open space, space preservation, and then oil field development. Now, oil field development's been there, but it's an industrial activity, and those do not mesh in residential and open space type environments, not without a lot of adaptation. And so, and of course, then you've got the agricultural component on top of that. Agriculture has become a very good friend of oil and gas because they've got, if you've got a crop circle on a piece of land, you can put meter facilities and compression on the corners. And now you've got this revenue generating piece of land that was weeds before. And, having kind of those components has been very challenging. Colorado's led the charge in figuring out how do we solve those problems. And how do we use the right equipment, reduce the things like flaring and emissions? So as we're going through testimony, that's what I was getting at, was my friend Luke Coates, who was part of one of the Energy Strong founders. There was a big issue with automating these sites, and there, people are sabotaging sites, and there was the sites themselves were safe, but a lot of times they weren't even fenced, right? So he developed a company called Clean Connect that worked with FLIR camera systems to develop cameras and sensor systems that 24/7 monitor remotely these facilities They've got tank monitoring, proprietary tank monitoring cameras that can see through the tanks. So you don't have to open a hatch or anything. You can see the levels in the tanks from the outside. You can see who's on site, what's on site, any sort of emissions. That was a very science-driven solution to a problem that we saw giving testimony at the state capitol and on all these town hall meetings. So Luke took the feedback we were getting and applied a solution to solve that problem. We just, you know, so that was an example of like the oil and gas community listening to residents of the surrounding area, what their concerns were, and applying it to a business. And now his business in that area, of course, is booming because it's a, yeah, it's a solution that makes sense. And it's realistically, it's something that the industry should do anyway. I mean, that's a no-brainer. It's a cheap, effective solution. It monitors your facility and it keeps your facility. It's one more layer of safety.
Yeah. No, it's interesting too. Like we can now see how some of this bad messaging, right, that we've been giving out or not providing to reinforce with good messaging, right, to the industry, to our communities, whatever, not answering their questions, has led to now somewhat of a movement of environmental terrorism. And now having to protect against that. Where do you see that going? Is that something that maybe operators aren't taking as seriously as they maybe should? Is that setting us up for, you know, as soon as somebody does something on this front, right, big news, right, and then it can make it even harder for our industry to come in the door again, you know, on the next pad or whatever. Where's this heading?
Your point's dead on. And I think a lot of people are thinking of that. You're starting to see a lot more fencing going up in these monitoring systems. But even 3-4 weeks ago, I think it was, when the Earth First group sabotaged a gas utility system up near Aspen. Yep. It stranded, I think, 3,800 meters. So like 6,000 people were without heating or gas and able to provide for their families in the middle of the winter up in the mountains. I mean, that's a true act of terrorism. It's putting people's lives at risk unnecessarily. And yeah, if somebody's that brazen to do that, that's a bellwether for something more. And it's all that more important why we need to go and explain why those things are important. You know, gas pipelines are the safest way to deliver any sort of energy. Mm-hmm. And delivering gas to the end user is the most efficient way to deliver a BTU to the end user. Those things are not a problem environmentally. Anything. They're environmentally safe. They're regulated. They fall under extremely rough, tough regulatory and what's the word I'm looking for?
Environmental.
environmental regulatory and integrity management programs, integrity. Right? So they're tested and they're pegged and they're looked at. The safety of those pipelines is the safest infrastructure on the planet. And, the oil and gas industry in Colorado, I've said this a lot, we should be exporting our model globally. We're serious about driving down emissions and worried about safety and delivering things ethically. The model that we've developed in Colorado through environmental regulatory compliance and doing things safely, if you exported that globally to countries in the Middle East and South America and China, you'd be driving down emissions. The natural gas industry has been the most effective at driving. The natural gas industry is the one industry in this country that's done the most to drive down emissions. U.S. leads the world in emissions reduction, and the natural gas industry is responsible for that mostly.
Yeah. No, a lot of good messaging there. And I wish people realize that too more. It's like whenever they're trying to literally shut off supply, you know, whether it being through Congress or whatever means just politically, it's not stopping the demand. So we're just going to ship that demand somewhere else and to areas of the country or other countries that don't do it near as responsibly.
You know, and we don't need to get, we got, I think, 10 or 15 minutes left. We don't have to go too far down that road. Right. But it's true, because if you look at states, we have test cases here. You can look at a case study like California. California's got some of the most rigorous anti-oil and gas policy in the country, right? Today, as we sit here today, California uses more oil and gas than they did in 1982, and they import 60% of their oil is imported from overseas, and most of that comes through the Strait of Hormuz, through the Middle East. Now, I'm not sure about you, but I don't know how loading oil up on a tanker halfway around the globe, shipping it through the Panama Canal and getting to California to offload it is greener. It's not. California sits on the third largest oil reserves in the country and should be producing that here with an EPA, with American labor and talent, with American ethics and kind of regulation, and providing to the end user with as little supply chain as possible. That's the solution. And I'm not against any sort of energy transition to anything, but it has to make sense. If you can't jump out of one boat before you jump into another, and that's what we're doing here is, yeah, wind and solar, those are important things, but they're unreliable. The battery storage isn't there yet. And I'm not ready to say, yeah, you know, rely on, especially after Texas. Denver's doing this thing right now where they're banning, after 2024, there's a bill to ban any new gas hookups. My natural gas fireplace is one of the things that's saved my life in the middle of the winter when my electricity's gone out. It's the one thing that keeps my house warm if my power's out for a day or two. And if I'm dependent on 100% on electricity and that goes out, which it does, that's a real health and safety risk in my view. So we have to message these things. The fact that oil and gas infrastructure, that the people are brazen enough to go attack that. I'm in the industry. I'd be terrified to shut down a mainline valve without knowing anything about it and what it would do consequently. It could blow up on you, or the pressure could split a pipeline, whatever. But the fact that these are being done is really a message to us. We really need to ramp up our messaging and inform and educate people on the safety and the importance of our industry.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I don't think anybody is, well, for the most part, I don't think us as an industry, we're saying no to renewables. We're saying just don't put all your eggs in one basket or think that one solution is all, you know, of the picture going forward. So
yeah, I'm a free market capitalist. So if the world wanted solar panels and wind turbines, then let it go there. I'm against
forcing
government
it.
Picking and choosing winners. And what happens is that, you know, energy poverty is a real thing. And I grew up with a single mom with three kids, and we grew up really poor. And our energy bill decided whether, you know, we had little luxuries in life or not. And that's true. Like, as we sit today, 33% of Americans are behind on their rent or their mortgage. Are they okay with their energy bill going up three or four times, or with a gas or electric bill going from $125 to $500? I wouldn't be, especially when oil and gas is a domestic resource that's not only geopolitically important, but say this area that we live in Denver is uninhabitable, and in the mountains, it's uninhabitable without oil and gas. So the real solution, in my view, is how does the oil and gas industry, and we're doing a great job of it now, is get more proactive in applying technologies to capture emissions and drive down emissions, mm-hmm. as opposed to banning it and then going with an unproven method.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the industry, I'll back up what you said. The industry is never, I've been in it for 16 years, never heard one person against wind or solar. They're not against it. Just want to make sure it makes sense. And the fact is the oil and gas industry, they procure probably more solar panels than almost any other heavy industrial application.
That's very
true. To power remote facilities and things like that. So we procured a lot of solar panels and applied that technology where it makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. And so I'd like you to kind of shift a little bit and talk more specifically about, you know, Energy Strong, that movement. I'm specifically interested in, you know, whenever we're going to talk to, you know, whether it be our neighbors or, you know, someone from, you know, political office, how do you overcome the bias that, well, we're from oil and gas and we're trying to tell you how great it is. But at the same time, it's like, well, nobody else is going to tell you this story. Like, you know, we've got to stand up for ourselves. But how do you overcome that bias and get that in or that buy-in with people to where they inherently trust what we're saying or know that we know what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough proposition. I've engaged the opposition at, you know, when I've been down at the state capitol, I ask people if they're for or against oil and gas, if they say they're against it. I certainly don't come at it from a very, you know, I'm not going to be aggressive, but I want to truly understand, what are you afraid of? You'll go to a gas station and fill up your car, and there's a lot of the same equipment. There's tanks, there's pumps. It's inherently dangerous, but it's been made safe through good, sound engineering and safety. So if you look at a gas station, all the tanks are underground. The pumps are behind this really pretty thing that says, you know, Valero or whatever on it. And you go in and get a pack of sunflower seeds. I mean, it's like a very, and then you look at a well pad facility. It's all the same stuff. It's just exposed. So you engage people and understand what are they really against. Most of the people that I've talked to are simply parroting a narrative they've heard about fracking or flaring that isn't true, but there's nobody there to tell them the other. Otherwise, it's a look at any social media platform, and the amount of disinformation on both sides is alarming. How do you win that trust? I don't know. When I talk to people, I'm in the industry because of the inherent good that it does. And when I look at the things that touch my lives, everything petrochemical makes it better. And it protects the oil and gas protects me from a hostile climate. The climate would kill me. I'm an avid camper. I know what it's like to be out for 5 or 6 days without the comfort of a home, without energy, without natural gas. And so maybe I'm just tuned into it a little different, but it's a tough one. I mean, people have called me a shill a lot. They call me all sorts of things, but I'm none of those things. I'm a guy that's proud of what he does and the stuff that we do. Basically what I translate to them is, look, you don't have to, just because I'm from oil and gas. Okay. That's on the table. I'm not going to hide that, but we have engineers and scientists that are educated in this state at prestigious universities, CU Boulder, Colorado School of Mines, CSU. Those are great schools that put out very good minds. These are the people solving these problems. Engineering should have the best story to tell. These are the people applying safety and making sure that things are safe and efficient and are sound. And we have a great story to tell. Who else would you want to hear it from? Because I don't want to take my energy advice from Donald Trump, and I don't want to take it from Joe Biden. I want to know from the people in the trenches what they're doing to make sure that they're safe and that I have reliable energy coming to my house. And yes, of course, I want to mitigate as much flaring and fugitive emissions as we can. We all do. That's a revenue stream. Oil and gas has always done a good job at that. So how do I overcome it? That's a tough one. It's always tough to really change anybody's mind on anything. The best thing we can do is educate people. We can put the facts out there, and the facts, we'll win on facts. We won't win on a narrative and emotions. We're not going to win on that, but we'll win on we'll win on facts, and we'll win on the industry record that, you know, fracking is one of the safest industrial processes in the entire on the planet. Oil and gas industry is one of the safest on the planet when you look at BLS statistics, Bureau of Labor statistics. And if you look at the reliability of natural gas power plants, no other source does as much heavy lifting. You just got to educate with facts. We're putting, with Energy Strong right now, we're finalizing production on a commercial that's going to air on during the news and on TV. Cool. You know, so that's a lot of money, but we're trying to scrape this thing together in grassroots just to educate people. I don't know if you remember the ExxonMobil egg commercial where it shows a woman in her apartment cooking an egg, and it kind of reverse supply chains the thing all the way back to the wellhead, you know, from her burner on her stove through the pipeline and the ships and the people. Very similar to that concept. And we're going to just educate people like that. You don't need to get up and scream at the top of your lungs that oil and gas is the best thing ever and renewables suck. It's not that. It's all energy, and it's what's the best application for the particular area. Oil and gas, it's a very important commodity. EIA, if you look at the EIA, it shows oil and gas consumption going up until 2050. And so there's a demand there. It's a consumer demand. We have to meet that demand. And, there's a very vocal minority against the industry. We should use that messaging to better harden our practices and better engage with the community to help them understand what we're doing and why it's important. Mm-hmm. But it is a tough proposition. Once you're in oil and gas, they assume that Energy Strong is completely voluntary. We don't get paid anything for it. We go to all this testimony, these town halls, because I believe in the industry and I want to make sure I'm standing up for what I believe in. It's more important now than ever for people to do that. When we go to these town hall meetings, a lot of times there's 6 or 7 people that we'll bring from Energy Strong, and there's 15 or 20 people in the community that are genuinely frightened and they don't want the deal. But if we had 100 or 150 oil and gas people, they're technical experts on air quality and engineering that could explain what we're doing, you would soften some of these people up and get them, but there's nobody there on the energy side to really tell the story at a local level on what we're doing. And that's really, really where we need to focus if we want to stand a chance to produce at any level here in Colorado and even nationally.
Yeah. And that's something I was hoping you'd kind of kick us in the butt a little bit on, but open our eyes a little bit to what specific, I know this is really kind of Colorado specific, but there's a lot of different events that go on or where you're saying that the advocacy would be nice. What are those things? What do we look for? And then should just anybody come? I mean, is there certain people that, like you said, like the engineers who are involved with, like,
fill that up for us. Yeah. So right now with Senate Bill 181, you have local control, right? And so the mission of the COGCC right now, and this model will probably be over time replicated in other states, but you have local control, county by county, municipality by municipality, on rules and regulations. So the subsurface geology doesn't know where those county lines are, but you have this patchwork now of regulations of varying degrees. So you need to understand what those are. People, right now it used to be, you know, town hall meetings, and, you know, Brighton's would be different from Commerce City, would be different from Greeley. They're all over the place. You had COGCC meetings and air quality meetings. You had all these things. And if you go to energystrong.com, there's a calendar there with all of the oil and gas events that we find. We put them on there. The upside of all the COVID lockdown stuff is now everything is Zoom calls. So you don't have to drive up to Erie to testify in front of a hostile crowd. You sign up and you say your piece. Who should talk? Everybody. Everybody from the truck drivers to the engineers to the businessmen to the industry leaders to the people in their community that are outside of the industry that want natural gas come into their house every day as a gas utility to protect their family from the environment and to keep a nice, warm, safe house. Everybody should go to those. And the more that we have for the oil and gas side, the better off we're going to be. The Energy Strong Group gets a lot of constant feedback from politicians and city council members that, hey, look, we have to listen to our constituents, and the constituents outnumber the oil and gas voice. And it's disheartening because the oil and gas story has such a good story to tell. You don't have to get up there and yell or scream. All you have to do is tell your story about every company that operates in oil and gas focuses on health and safety and environment. They have overhead positions that they pay these people that are non-profit making entities to come in and say, do this safer and do it more. You know, they're monitoring these types of things. And if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they're safe. We have to get on there. We have to mobilize. And people don't want to do it. I never thought it'd be a mouthpiece for it. I wanted to run a business and ride a motorcycle in the summer. I don't want to go to town hall meetings or COGCC meetings, but I do. And it's really important that we really, right now, voices are important. More than ever, probably in our lifetimes, people's voices are being heard. Whether it's minority groups, whether it's oil and gas groups, whether it's anti-oil and gas groups, politicians are really keyed into listening to constituents and engaging with them in town hall meetings. We have to go to those. We have to show up as an industry and even as individuals. No one pays us to go, but we go. And, you know, it's interesting. I was terrified the first few times I do it. Now I can't wait to talk about it. I'm genuine about it. I'm not doing it for profit. I'm not, no one's paying me to be there. I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do. And if we don't stand up for our industry, we're going to get overtaken by a narrative and all of our energy bills are going up and we're going to be using an unreliable energy or importing our energy from somewhere else. We can do that here and we should really stand up for that industry.
Yeah. I like your message too. It's like, if you've got some, you know, if air and emissions come up, if you've got an air and emissions, like a fella in that room that can talk about it, like just having those assets there. I think that's something that maybe we
having air quality people and engineers there by far is more impactful. But even if you have, you know, everyone in that supply chain of oil and gas is important, even the consumer, you know, if you had like a couple of the meetings, we had HOA groups come up and say, hey, we want this production. It helps our community raise money and people have better property values because of it.
Or goodness, people who get royalty checks from this money.
That's right.
I mean, where are they at? I don't know.
It's all over. I mean, they do show up and they fought part of the capital because they're having, it's a taking, they're taking property rights away from people.
For sure.
So it's a very complex issue. And for me personally, you know, you talk to somebody like, yeah, windmills, if they're off the horizon, we don't see them, great, you know, use that energy. Me personally, I'd rather live next to a production facility than a huge windmill. So we just got to, you know, to each their own. We've got to educate people. We have to stand up and mobilize. That's the most important thing over the next couple of years. Make a goal, challenge yourself. I know it's uncomfortable. I know people don't like to do it. By and large, the oil field, they want to go to work their 8, 10, 12-hour day and come home. Right. Pick one or two events. Go to the Energy Strong website. Look at an event on the calendar. Put it on your calendar. It's a Zoom call. It's just like this. It's very, stay in your pajamas. You don't have to turn your video on. And just talk about what you do and how you do it and your view of the oil field. And it helps tell the story that the oil and gas industry does care about the environment. And, and we do care about safety. And we do care about the communities we work and operate in.
Yeah. And I will say, too, I don't want to make this sound like it's just a pure Colorado-centric episode. I mean, y'all got, you know, Colorado or Energy Strong Ohio, Energy Strong Pennsylvania, Energy Strong Texas, right? You all have broken out across the nation.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff to get involved with.
Yeah, and you look at Texas and Wyoming, they looked at Colorado a year ago and thought, man, what a bunch of crazy wackos. Rightfully so. I mean, we're in the middle of this very complex dilemma, right?
Yep.
Texas today is in the same position Colorado was a year ago. You've got a pretty decent anti-oil and gas sentiment going on. They're questioning whether they should be developing close to people's homes, how much infrastructure is too much. Is oil and gas the long-term solution? And same thing in Wyoming, where there's a lot of federal land. Now they've got a big problem there because of so much federal land. So
yeah,
the Energy Strong Group, of course, it was founded in Colorado, but we feel like Colorado, that is an advantage because Colorado was kind of the first out of the gate in a lot of this regulation, figuring out how the heck do we survive. And yeah, now we're having events in Wyoming and North Dakota and Texas and reaching out. And just really what we're trying to do is connect people across the country to have talking points. Here's the real story, good and bad. You know, there's things we need to improve on. Flaring, we gotta let's put that out there. The freeze ups we had in California, we highlighted a company that's been an Energy Strong kind of sponsor of events called Neo Insulation. It's a local company out of Colorado and Wyoming that's got a patented neoprene insulation technique. We highlighted that for some of the Texas operators, not as a shameless plug, but as, hey, there's a solution out here. It's very cost-effective insulation. You don't have to worry about that valve and pipe next time. Yeah, maybe you won't need it for 5 years, but you got it, and it's a little sleeve, right? So we're trying to highlight some of the solutions to some of the problems and really just connect the industry and then, again, get into some commercials and get into some advertising and really pick up the baton and run with it, because we really don't see anybody else doing it. You see a lot of commercials and a lot of print advertisements around election time, and then it goes silent for 2 to 4 years. Right. We want a constant drip of this is the inherent good that we're doing. Here's what we do to give back to the community, and here's how we're being proactive to meet and exceed any sort of regulatory goals that we have.
Yeah, for sure. So I know we're pretty much towards the end of the episode here. I'm going to turn it over to Nick. Nick, how's all this sit with you? What's your perspective, you know, being a college student now about to come into all this? What's your final remarks here? Any questions you got?
You know, from my perspective as a budding petroleum engineer, I have, you know, presumably 60 years of life left in me, and, you know, 50 some out of that hopefully will be working in the oil and gas industry. For me and many of my peers, it's easy to kind of be a little hopeless about the future. You know, I was interning last summer with a company out of California, and it seems like the regulatory condition there goes from bad to worse to worse to worse. And certainly the image that the industry has doesn't really seem to be getting any better. It's always been at worse, you know, even for the last several decades. Energy Strong, I think, is a great thing. I've been exposed to Energy Strong even, you know, this early into my career, and I think it's a great thing. But certainly there needs to be more. What, Jack, from your perspective, what do you think really needs to take place? I mean, it seems like if we get, you know, a few dozen of us going to town hall events, you know, that will help to kind of turn the tide. But certainly there needs to be some kind of institutional shift in the way we talk about energy and the way we think about energy, you know, nationally and internationally. I know you've kind of touched on some of those points already, but to answer that question specifically and explicitly and quickly, what would you say?
Mobilize. So not only proactively engage with your neighbors and tell them, you know, these are the policies being instituted, and these are real world impacts. And you can look at Germany or California for energy prices on what is going to happen. Are you okay with that? If you are, cool. Sit on the sideline. If you don't, you wanted to basically, we ban it here. We import it from somewhere else. We effectively offshore those emissions and those work practices. So not only are you exporting emissions, but you're amplifying those emissions because other countries don't have an EPA. It's regulated great here. So how do you get, we got to mobilize. We've got 75 plus thousand members of Energy Strong that are on an email list and that are part of like our LinkedIn and our Facebook networks. And we put out, you know, you would think, man, if we get 1% of these people to respond, we would overwhelm anything and it would be a great story. We can't because people don't want to mobilize. And I totally understand it, but we have to, like, especially this younger generation getting into it. It's an exciting time to be getting into oil and gas because there's a revolution going on that's being forced on how do we win these people over. This is an exercise in marketing and doing the right thing and being ethical and applying technology to solve problems. I mean, you're going to have a different set of problems to solve than people did 5 years ago or even a year ago. But we have to mobilize. You have to get this younger generation in there. We have to get industry leaders to step out from behind the industry affiliation groups and talk on their own on what their companies are doing and engage with the news channels and advertising channels to get the message out there. Energy Strong is going to start doing it. We're spending a lot of money that we've raised through happy hours and things like that to put it together. And we'll try, but we, you know, just like anything, going to class, going to work, attendance is key. If we can't get that, we're overtaken by a narrative, and that narrative has legs. Whether it's the right narrative or not, whether we agree with it or not, we can't sit on Facebook and complain about it. We have to, the politicians, the local communities, they have the power now. And in Colorado, we have to go engage those communities. California, we'll see. I mean, in my view, I think what happens is this thing runs its course until gasoline gets to $6 a gallon and your energy bills tripled. Mm-hmm. And then the common people that haven't been paying attention or didn't really care are going to revolt. You're going to be pressured to reopen some federal lands and do it domestically here, because all that's going to happen, we don't have the technology or the infrastructure to just ban oil and gas and go live on solar panel. We're going to have to import that from somewhere, and importing it costs more money, and economics matter to people.
Yeah. No, I think you got a really good message there too about the young voices. So Nick, for example, you and I, right? There's especially with today's social media, right? There's a lot of power in having a young voice, and you're talking about being discouraged. I get comments on our YouTube channel too about people, you know, Shikman knowing guys, you know, just not knowing what to expect, not knowing that not everybody that goes in, you know, that for the majority of people who go into oil and gas, you know, we're environmentalists, you know, having that narrative behind it.
Exactly right.
So I think, you know, getting your voice out there, getting my voice out there, just not being afraid to, you know, get the voice out there. There's power in young voices today, especially
there really is. And especially, like I said, if I was coming into the oil and gas industry as an engineer right now, I'd be excited. There's some major challenges and all that. People are shifting away from it, so it's going to open up, you know.
And that just means we had to come up with innovative solutions.
Better ideas. This is going to spur a lot of innovation. And, it'll be a unique challenge. But I'm not afraid of it. It's frustrating at times, like the narrative I see. But you know what? One foot in front of the other. The fact, if you can get to these meetings and we can mobilize groups of people to these meetings, it's empowering, because then you see other people doing it. And then you're like, yeah, that is the right story. I didn't think of that. It's where oil and gas has been worst, marketing and advocating for themselves. Terrible at it. We have to fix that. Otherwise, in another 10 years, there's going to be nothing left. We have to fight. We have to change the narrative, and you do that by showing up and talking to people.
Yeah. And we definitely still can do it. We're not that far down the path, but important to very glad to have you on this episode here, Jack, and talking over a lot of this really important messaging. And hopefully this sits well in the ears of everybody listening. And then we can start thinking about more ways to make a difference in our own industry. And honestly, even, and you know, that'll trickle down into a difference of the next 20, 30 years of the country.
Sure. But, well, I'm going to share this, you know, once you release it on my networks.
For sure.
And give yourself, I've checked out your Oilfield Basics, but you want to give that a quick plug, because we are starting to get to Energy Strong, starting to get back into schools, career days, and engage like some local communities on what we do. So go ahead and give yourself a plug.
Well, I appreciate that. And I look forward to, we definitely need to talk and see how we can do some things together on that front. And I love the education side of it, especially, you know, the communities and everything. So definitely keep us plugged in there. But thank you so much for joining us here today. And Nick, glad to have you on as a co-host. Hope to be doing more of these here in the future with you. But glad to have you both on today.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate the time.
Thank you, and thanks everybody for listening. Thanks for tuning in to another episode, and please consider leaving us a review, sharing it with a friend, and checking out the dozens of online courses that we have at oilfieldbasics.com. So until next time, guys, take care, and we'll catch you in the next episode.